Galatians chapter 4, verse 28. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what saith the Scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. That verse 1 of Galatians chapter 5 goes a long way to covering all that I want to deal with this evening in this millennial milestone message. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again in the yoke of bondage. The 17th century saw such a bewildering array of very important and significant events that selecting a millennial milestone from any of those events, however important, means ignoring others that cry out for recognition. Remember that it was the 17th century that saw the great climax of the struggles of the French Huguenots. The same century saw the final repudiation of the gospel by France as a nation, with all that that entailed. I will make no further comment, for I spent one of our recent Octobers dealing with the Reformation in France and the tragedy of a nation that quickly felt the power of the gospel and came to such a position that within a few years, fully a third of the population professed faith in Jesus Christ, only within a brief time to have the nation throttled to spiritual death by a return to the paganism of popery. The 17th century saw the near annihilation of the Waldenses, their being driven from their beloved valleys, their arrival in Geneva, and then their courageous return to their homeland. The 17th century in Europe witnessed mighty battles of the Protestants of Bohemia, of Sweden, of Poland, and of the Netherlands, as they sought to fight off the tyranny of Rome and establish a basis of gospel liberty in their nations. It was also the century of the 30 Years' War from 1618 to the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, a war of religion, a war that for all the political and national infighting and all the side issues that muddy up the waters, nonetheless was ultimately a war of light and darkness. On the theological front, the 17th century was the century that gave rise to Arminianism and to the great controversy between Arminianism and the Reformed faith, a controversy that ever since has divided the witness of the Protestant churches. Against this semi-Pelagian departure from the faith, the Reformed churches produced In 1618, the famed canons of the Synod of Dort. Then in 1643, the Westminster Confession of Faith. Later, in 1658, the Congregationalists issued the Savoy Declaration. And a little later, toward the end of the century, the Baptists issued the London Baptist Confession, later taken over almost entirely as the Philadelphia Confession of Faith among Baptists in this nation. And all these confessions, differing in little matters of church polity, etc., all these confessions, whether they were Congregationalist, Baptist, Presbyterian, or other branches of the Reformed family, they all established the biblical Calvinistic faith of the Protestant churches in the face of the opposition of Arminianism. The early part of the 16th century saw the birth of the first English Baptist churches. Now, I know that that will not sit well with some Baptists. There is a theory that the Baptist churches in England traced their way all the way back to the ministry of the Apostle Paul, who is supposed to have visited Britain. And when they say Britain, probably what we nowadays call Wales. I think that whatever the truth or otherwise of such claims, and other groups make similar claims. Historically, what we know as Baptist churches in the English-speaking world first arose early in the 16th century. Among English people, first in Holland, although that didn't really amount to anything in the long term, to the establishment of Baptist churches in the homeland, the Baptist churches there started not as an outgrowth of European Anabaptism. And I want to emphasize that, though it's nothing to do with my subject tonight, but I want to emphasize that because it grieves me sorely when I hear American Baptists, and I don't mean that the denomination of American Baptists, I mean Baptists who are Americans. It grieves me sore to hear preachers ignorantly claim the Anabaptists of Europe as the root of the Baptist movement in the English-speaking world. And I don't say that out of any other motive other than it robs Baptists in America of the enjoyment of their true history. They did not come out of European Anabaptism, which was a sort of mixed movement, vastly tainted with serious heresy. They came out of the groups of English independents and separatists, and early in the 16th century formed Baptist churches, which later split into two. Does that sound familiar? Presbyterians did exactly the same. Into two, and then into two twos, four, and into four fours, 16, and that's how I think they call that multiplying, in this case dividing, exponentially. But anyway, we'll not get into that. Some of them Arminian, General Baptists, and then some of them Calvinistic, particular Baptists. And if you want to read more of that history, please do so. For an introduction, you can see one of the longest articles in my theological dictionary, and it will at least be an introduction to you to a vaster subject. Now, a lot of these are subjects of vast importance to the Church of Christ. They're attractive subjects, and they're worthy of close examination. And yet tonight I've got to set them all aside and try to concentrate attention on a series of related movements and events in England and in her American colonies. I say a related series of movements and events, but the relation is not always easy to see. The 17th century started in England with the death of Queen Elizabeth I, the accession to the English throne as James I of England, the young man who was already crowned King of Scotland, James VI of Scotland, the son of the famous Scottish royal beauty, Mary, Queen of Scots, whose head Elizabeth had had to sever from her body for treason. So he came to the throne. That was the beginning of the ill-fated rule of the House of Stuart in England. The Stuart dynasty that would launch the country into the bitterness and bloodshed of civil war and would forever divide English opinion on whether it was right or not to cut off the head of Charles Stuart, Charles I of England, again for treason against his own people. The Stuart dynasty would ruin the land morally with the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 with Charles II, bringing in a flood of European immorality and turning England into a moral mess after the blessings of the Puritan period. Then it would of course cause particular hardship in the Stuart homeland of Scotland, drenching the heather bells of Scotland with blood in a base effort to force the Scottish Covenanters to accept the semi-popish religion of the monarchs. When James I came to the throne in 1603, he was met immediately by the millenary petition. That was from, or so-called, because it carried the signature of about 1,000 Puritans. Now let me just stop here for a minute. We use the word Puritan, and yet scholars are arguing and wrangling over what does the term mean. I'm not even going to try to get into that at all tonight. Puritan, a movement difficult to define. But I like what Martin Lloyd-Jones had to say about the Puritans. He said that John Knox was the real founder of English Puritanism. And that thrills my heart as a good Presbyterian. John Knox, the father of Scottish Presbyterianism, the founder of English Puritanism. It's true that Puritanism rests on a foundation ultimately led by men like Wycliffe and later Tyndale. But John Knox was the man whose words and actions first set the movement in motion. It had as its key idea something that its millenary petition made clear, and that was the purification of the English National Church from all the remnants of popish practice and belief, and pleading for liberty of conscience in matters of indifference to many people, but matters of conscience to many evangelicals, looking for liberty of conscience in forms of worship in the national church. James received this and was very, very unhappy. Did not like the idea of meeting with Puritans. He had just escaped the Presbyterians in Scotland. The Presbyterians had raised him. Perhaps one thing that he didn't like was that the old Presbyterian scholar and poet Geordie Buchanan had not only helped to raise him, but had raised lumps in a certain part of his anatomy when as a little boy he was not doing his work. And I'll not tell you the conversation that went on with one of the maids at that time as she said, "What he had done with the Lord's anointed?" To put it in nice modern English, he said, "I have scalped his bottom." That's what I've done with the Lord's anointed. And then he threatened to do a whole lot more. With that experience, perhaps to help him, James never felt, like none of the Stuarts ever felt, that Presbyterianism was a religion fit for a gentleman. It was certainly not fit for monarchs. So he escaped the Presbyterians only to come down to find that now he was face to face with the Puritans. However, the Puritans proposed that there would be a conference of all sides in the theological and ecclesiastical debate. And that pleased James, because you see, as the French called him, he was the wisest fool in Christendom. That's how the French court looked on James. Highly educated, after all, he was educated by Presbyterians. Highly educated. He looked upon himself as an educated and very able theologian. And he really rose to the idea of all these theologians of the realm having a conference with King James as the chairman. So he convened a conference at Hampton Court. But from the very beginning, it really wasn't much of a conference. He kept the Puritans waiting outside the door for most of the time. He demeaned them. He despised them. Wherever he could, he mocked them and their positions. Refused to countenance any of the legitimate demands that they brought. Furthermore, he threatened. Now, this was a conference of all parties, supposed to be the conference that would bring a settlement to the religious disputes of England. He threatened to persecute them, and especially to persecute the separatists among them. Those were the people who had got so sick of intolerance, etc., in the Church of England that they could see no future in remaining in the national church. And given up attendance at national church services, he threatened to break them all. So it was not an auspicious conference. I was reading this morning in the 76th Psalm that the Lord makes the wrath of man to praise him. How ironic then that was the very conference that gave to the English-speaking world the greatest single gift that ever came out of the 17th century. And I'm referring to the authorized version of the Scriptures. And you will notice what I call it, the authorized version of the Scriptures, not the King James Version. It rankles me to put the name of a persecutor of God's people, a man who, from all my reading, was almost certainly a practicing sodomite, a vile and wicked wretch. It grieves me to have his name stuck at the front of the Bible. In the manner of the times, the translators wrote a wonderful preface. To the most high and mighty Prince James, by the grace of God, King of Great Britain and Ireland, Sir France and Ireland, Defender of the Faith, etc. That's how they did things in those days. And he was all those things. And they owed something to him for having this work done. But that's all past. It's the authorized version of the Scriptures. Now, it's not my job to preach in the translation of the Bible tonight. I will simply say this to you. It is still the greatest English version of the Scripture. I hear that we need to get to some new versions. Why? Because people don't understand the old version. And yet, here's a strange thing. I find that the people who love and read the old authorized version are the people who really know the Bible. They're the people who memorize the Bible. They're the people who seem to understand the Bible. And these people with all their little new translations that make everything so clear, I have never met a more muddled up bunch in my life. This was God's gift to the English nation. Now, the strange thing is the Puritans did not accept it in a hurry. They were wedded to their Geneva Bible. It's back in circulation. Geneva Bible, the Bible of the English Protestants in one of the darkest periods of their history. But after a while, this became the Bible of the English-speaking world. When you spoke about the Bible, nobody had any doubt as to what you were talking about. And wherever it went, the light of God followed it. The blessing of God followed it. It was blessed with revival upon revival upon revival. In many ways, the only translation of the Scriptures among English people that has had that blessing of God attendant upon its ministry. So, James, despite his hatred of the Puritan cause, did accept a proposal from one of his bishops to have this translation made from the original Scriptures, and in 1611 it was produced. Of course, it didn't change James's hostility to the cause of Christ, and that hostility led many Christians to flee from England to Holland, where they enjoyed a much fuller level of freedom to worship. Indeed, from about 1607 to 1620, Holland remained a sanctuary for many distressed English Protestants. But ultimately, trouble met them there. The Arminian controversy had arisen, and it began to overflow into very bitter feelings. And the overflow even reached the English Protestants, and they were more often than not simply identified as Arminians when they weren't. Let them see that they could have no continuing city. Now we come to a part where I will be brief, because you know the old saying, well, maybe you don't over here, but in Britain we have an old saying about carrying coals to Newcastle. Newcastle was the center of the coal mining industry. To try and sell coals, say go from London to Newcastle, you had to be off your head to go there to sell coals. Well, I'm in America, so I'll not in this Newcastle try to sell coal, because we now come to the famed year of 1620. If you don't recognize the date, shame on you. In 1620, at great personal sacrifice and displaying indomitable determination, the Pilgrim Fathers sailed to America, to be followed in the decade that had just started by many Puritans who established themselves in the Massachusetts area. In 1625, James died, to be replaced by his son Charles I, who made his religious sympathies clear by marrying the Roman Catholic French Princess Henrietta. His policies were utterly disastrous to the kingdom and kept him in constant conflict with his elected parliament, and also with his subjects in Scotland. In England, he tried to rule without a parliament, and did so for quite a few years, until finally he could not do it any longer, because he needed parliament which had the power of taxation. He needed parliament to regather, to provide him with the money to prosecute his war against the Scots. It was in Scotland that he was exercising all his power and all his deceitfulness to break the nation's allegiance to its Presbyterian beliefs and practices. So he summoned Parliament. He summoned what was known as the Long Parliament, for the reason that it sat for 11 years. One of the first things it did when he called it was to enact that he couldn't dissolve it, as he had done before. That was the beginning of the end for Charles, because he would not moderate his arrogant folly, and the Parliament would not accommodate it. England was crying out for a genuine settlement of the grievances of the people, especially a religious settlement. And Parliament, not altogether from the purest of motives in every case, though certainly from pure motives in many cases, Parliament was determined to see that they got it. In the end, the struggle could only be settled on the field of battle. Two civil wars, one hard on the heels of the other, finally rid England of Charles and his treacheries, and led to his beheading after being tried and found guilty of treason against his own people. And the Parliament then set up first a Republic and Commonwealth, and then Cromwell's Protectorate, when he ruled as an absolute ruler. After Cromwell's death, the monarchy was restored with devastating effects. Charles II destroyed the moral fiber of the nation. He quickly forgot and forswore all the promises he had made to the people to gain their acceptance. And especially, he was despicable in his treating of the Scots, who at great personal risk were the very first ones to crown him and to bring him back. But those same Scots were the people whom he subjected to unrelenting persecution. He was followed by his brother James II, who was an open papist, and who went even further, and who introduced to Scotland an era very brief but very bloody. It was called the Killing Times, against the Scottish Covenanters. And then came what we in Britain know as the Glorious Revolution. Almost 100 years before the American colonies had their revolution, the British had theirs. Finally, fed up with the papist James and all his wickedness, the people overthrew him and replaced him with his son-in-law, William, Prince of Orange. Now, here's a little side alley. I'm not going to go up it. Some of you hear the news from Northern Ireland, and you hear about Orange men having a procession, and you think this must be something from Florida or something from Disney World. What are Orange men? What have Oranges got to do? Nothing. William, Prince of Orange, the House of Orange, was the royal house of Holland. And William married Mary, and he and Mary were co-monarchs, followed then by Queen Anne. But that's the Orange connection. And when William was established, the Glorious Revolution was established, the Bill of Rights was signed, and that, believe it or not, is the nearest thing we have in Britain to a written constitution. We don't have a fully written constitution. Our constitution is built up over many, many centuries of common law. And this is the nearest thing to a formal constitution. In fact, it is formal. And that Glorious Revolution ushered out James, and I'm glad to tell you that when he was finally defeated, the coup de grace was given to him in Ireland. In what we think of as a great battle at a great river, it's actually now in the south of Ireland. When you come to that river, it's rather disappointing, for it's rather like a trickle in somebody's backyard compared to a real river. But at the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, William defeated James and his French cohorts and his papist troops, and England's revolution was complete. Now, the common theme of all this century is one that has to resonate with us today. The Separatists, the Puritans, the Independents, the Presbyterians, and the Baptists were divided on many issues. But one thing they shared was what I will call a quest for purity and for liberty. Now, I have to be honest and tell you, they didn't always define those terms in the same way. And I have to be honest again and say that they didn't always accord to their brethren the liberty that they claimed for themselves. But in saying that, all I'm saying is they were men. They were not suddenly made into sinless angels. They were men, with all the foibles and failures of men. But nevertheless, they did share this quest for purity and for liberty. And they finally gained both with considerable degrees of success. Tonight what I want to do as we come toward the close is take three vital examples. The first is very much American. The pilgrims and the Puritans who came to America came on this quest. Both of these groups had suffered harsh treatment under James I. The separatists, numerically, were not very great. And even those who came to set up the colony in America, the separatists were really a minority, a small minority of the total who came. But nonetheless, their influence, their importance, their significance was much, much vaster than their numbers would suggest. The separatists had started their own churches. They could see no hope for staying in the national church. There was no hope for spiritual worship. And so they set up their own little assemblies. They met at places, you can read all about it in Dr. Beale's book. You'll read all the details. The places that have become famous in church history. A little congregation in Gainsborough. Another congregation at Scrooby Manor. Actually, there you find two names that were to become famous in American history. There you come across Elder William Brewster, worshiping alongside of him a young man of 18 who was to attain great fame in the colonies, William Bradford. Names that, of all people on earth, you should know. There they worshipped, hoping that their own land would allow them the liberty to be faithful to their God and to their conscience according to the Scripture. But in the end, they had to choose between their homeland and their faith. And they chose their faith. They could leave England, but they could never leave Christ. That was the mindset. That was the heart of the men who first, and the women, who first came as pilgrims and Puritans to this nation. What a testimony. The hardships they faced before they left England. The dangers they faced in even making plans and preparations to get to America. The difficulties that overcame them as they tried and failed to get away, having finally to give up one of the ships in which they had hoped to travel. And then the dangers and the pain and the suffering and sometimes even the death. It stalked them in their famous Mayflower voyage, and similar voyages that followed in the decade to come. And then their subduing of the new land in which they had arrived, all these things should stir our deepest, sincerest admiration. I don't think you could imagine a better basis on which to build a nation than those men who came to Massachusetts. This was not a penal colony. Other nations were built on the dregs of English society, banished by courts to a foreign land. Not so in America. This nation was built upon the cream of the English Protestant people. In any view of the 17th century and the work of God in that century, the laying of the foundation of what was soon to become the greatest nation on earth must take pride of place. And yet, you know, building a nation was the farthest thing from the mind of the Pilgrims and the Puritans who came to America. They didn't come to set up a nation. They came to pursue purity, and they came to pursue liberty. What a lesson for us. They were few. They were underfunded. They faced impossible odds. But through it all, they were faithful to God and to the vision that He gave them. The lesson is that if we are faithful to our God in that to which He has set our hand, He will see us through and do great things for us. These Pilgrims and Puritans did achieve a high degree of purity. I know it's the in thing to mock the Puritans as sour, long-faced, anti-social, half-animal regressions, evolutionary mistakes. Don't you believe it? You should read the book that's called Worldly Saints. Worldly Saints. Using the word worldly in a deliberately provocative sense, saying that they were not otherworldly and useless on earth, but very much they had their feet on the ground. If you want a real insight into the Puritan mentality, that's the book to read. They laid the basis for every liberty in which this nation can take pride. Notice what I said, they laid the basis. But they left it to every succeeding generation to pursue the quest for purity and for liberty. And they would have shuddered at the modern American idea. What does America say? What is the government's rationale for intervening in any part of the world to export liberty, never to export purity? Sadly, that is a charge that modern America could never be found guilty of. It has befouled the nations of the world with a filthy stream from Hollywood. It has allowed the dregs of hell that have poisoned this nation to make their billions by poisoning every other nation. America has not done a great job at exporting purity. And the Pilgrim Fathers would shudder at the thought that you can have liberty without purity. For you can't. The idea that you can ban God and Christianity from the very heartbeat of the nation and yet have a nation that has liberty was something that would have been an utter anti-Christian abomination to the founding fathers of this nation. Purity and liberty. That was their quest. And that's the quest that they have left to this generation of Americans to pursue again. The purity of the gospel and the purity of life that comes from that pure gospel. And then the liberty that is guaranteed not by governmental fiat, not by some decision of Supreme Court justices. They may confirm it, but that is guaranteed to a free people who know their God in the glory of the gospel of grace. That's the quest. The founding fathers pursued it. Their very memory exhorts you to pursue it too. Second, may I give the example of the English Puritans. That's the ones who stayed in England, for they were all English Puritans to start with. Oliver Cromwell and the English Puritans were on the same quest for purity and for liberty. Indeed, so much so, Oliver Cromwell was very tempted to emigrate to America. It's one of those little things in history you wonder, what would have happened if Cromwell had come to America? Well, all I can say, I can give you my opinion, America would have been a whole lot better off, and England today would be in the pits. Well, it's morally there anyway, but its great history would probably never have come to pass. I'm very grateful to God that he kept Cromwell, another man whom it is easy to demonize, and all the popular writers love to mock him. He's a hypocrite. He's a self-serving liar. He's a bloodthirsty monster. He drenched Ireland in blood. The truth of the matter is, in the words of John Milton, Cromwell is our chief of men. It's very interesting to me, the best biography I know on Oliver Cromwell was written by an Irish Roman Catholic, Lady Antonia Fraser, daughter of Lord Longford, one of the most ancient of Southern Ireland's Roman Catholic aristocratic families. Antonia Fraser, a very capable historical biographer. When she did the research, she came to title her book on Oliver Cromwell. She chose that description of Milton. Her book is simply called Cromwell, Our Chief of Men. Cromwell, the parliamentary forces, for he was a cavalry leader, then a commander-in-chief, as well as being a member of parliament and then the leader of the nation ultimately. Cromwell and the parliamentary forces gained their victory at a very great cost. Two civil wars with Charles I and his cavaliers. When I was growing up, every book about that period, every television story that they especially put out for children, you always had these swashbuckling cavaliers. They were handsome. They were men of honor. They were the good guys. The roundheads. The Cromwellian forces. They were dour, stern, hateful, scary. If you wanted to scare your children, you'd have said, I'm going to show you one of those roundheads. And you find yourself loving the cavaliers. It shows you the power of film and the power of print. Loving the cavaliers. The actual fact is the other way around. It was the cavaliers who were the instruments of tyranny. It was the roundheads who were the instruments of liberty. It fell to Oliver Cromwell and his roundheads to humble Charles I and his pretension to the divine right of kings, and to begin the long journey to liberty. That journey took them to famous victories in the field of battle. In English history, the Battle of Marston Moor, the Battle of Naseby, and others. But these are focal points in modern English history where, under the discipline of a man of God, can you imagine it? A military commander who rid his army of impurity and immorality because he said we cannot expect the blessing of God unless we are living right and we're fighting for the glory of God. A military commander whose soldiers lived the gospel. Hard to believe nowadays. But that's what they did. And God used them to drive Charles and his cavaliers into defeat. However, this is the flip side, and what a lesson it has for God's people in every age. Those who were united to oppose the tyranny of the monarchy could not agree to work together once power was in their hand. And I have to confess that every time I go back to read that period of English history, I see some of the greatest statesmen, certainly in the person of Oliver Cromwell, I believe the greatest statesman that England has had, a man to whom we owe more than to any other single man in our modern history. Others, men of character, men of Christianity. And yet, when they came to power, Presbyterians would not be satisfied unless the whole country was Presbyterian and accepted the divine right of presbytery. Now, I'm a Presbyterian, but I say that was a tragedy. Independence being just as thick-headed about their independency. Men who had agreed enough to drive the devil out couldn't agree enough to keep him out. When I dealt with some battles in the covenanting history of Scotland in detail some years ago, I pointed out that the covenanters could go to Drumclog and they could win a mighty victory united for the glory of God. Not long after at Bothwell Bridge, they were divided among themselves, one brother against another, and they simply fell like flies before the enemy. Is there not something there for us to learn? Oliver Cromwell had as much trouble with the Parliament and the people who had supported him as the King had had. And ultimately he had to throw them all out and govern single-handedly. But that could be no more than a temporary measure because there was nobody else in the land who had the vision, the presence, and the power of Cromwell to rule. The years of his protectorate, the years of his ascendancy, made great gains for the quest of purity and liberty. Of all the people who had a vision for one Christian church that yet had room in it for people of different persuasions, whether they were Presbyterian or Baptist or Independent, he was the man with the vision. I think some of the theologians had the vision. Not all. Some of them had. I said this morning that John Bunyan had some of the most advanced and enlightened views on the union of Christians. But that kind of view is remarkable because so many others didn't have it. Cromwell had it in abundance. And so there was some progress, though, sad to say, it was among professing believers. that the seeds were sown for the destruction of the work of the Puritans. To those years of conflict and trouble, we owe some of the greatest gems of English theology. The Westminster Confession of Faith, the single greatest confession of the Reformed faith anywhere to be found. The mature thinking of the Protestant Reformed churches in 1643 produced in that tempestuous time. The great body of Puritan literature, which now, thank God, is becoming more and more available with reprints here in our own day. The Puritan preachers represent English experimental. The word that you will normally hear is experiential. For some reason or other, I hate that word. I don't know why. I don't think it should be a word. But anyway, who am I to say? But English experimental theology, vital doctrine that exalts the glory of God, the all-sufficiency of Christ, that really deals with the conscience in the light of God's Word and God's Gospel, that was all at its best in the Puritan period, the flower of Reformed thinking. If you have never read any Puritan literature, it's time to start. An awful lot of preachers have never cracked a Puritan book. Some years ago, I had a university professor from the United Kingdom visit me in Greenville. He wasn't here specifically to visit me. He visited me while he was in Greenville. He was a sociologist. His books are used in universities, state universities, around Britain and around the world. And his particular field of expertise is evangelicalism and fundamentalism. And of course he had to visit Bob Jones to see what this citadel of fundamentalism was all about. And I have to say that he was very impressed and very honest in his treatment of it. But we were over in the old church in Sharon Drive at the time, and we had a little bookshelf there, and we had some Puritan volumes up that the students could go to. I think I just got in the works of John Owen or something, and it was not my library. There's no way I was going to let my books loose among those fellows. But it was just a shelf or two of Puritan volumes, and he came in, and he looked, and he did a second take, and he said, "You know, I have been in pastor studies all across America. I practically never see those books." Now, he was a professing agnostic. He had read them. And sometimes preachers won't even read them. This is the flower of English theology. Practical truth. Read it. Start with your confession of faith. Start with your shorter catechism. Learn it. Learn the proofs that go with it. Get it into your heart and into your soul. Get some of the volumes of Thomas Watson, A Body of Divinity, his treatment of the Ten Commandments, his treatment of the Lord's Prayer. It's really just an exposition of the Catechism. Read it. Get Joseph Alleyne's Alarm to the Unconverted, or Baxter's Call to the Unconverted. Read these things and you'll see they will set your soul on fire for God and for truth. After Cromwell's death, there were 30 years of great loss for the Puritan quest, but it wasn't ultimately lost or wasted, for a nation that has tasted the liberty of the gospel will not be easily brought forever under the bondage and tyranny of Rome again. And as I've said, we had our glorious revolution when Puritanism came to its full harvest. The final example I'll give, and I can be brief here because I have in the past dealt with this in detail, and though you may not have heard it, it will simply be a matter of me saying, see Miss Cromley for the tapes. The Scottish Covenanters were on the same quest for purity and for liberty. The name Covenanter comes from the signing of what is called the National Covenant by Scottish Presbyterians in 1638, pledging themselves to maintain the principles of the Scottish Reformation. Charles I and Archbishop Laud, his right-hand ecclesiastical henchman and axeman, they decided they were going to un-Presbyterianize Scotland and make it into an episcopacy, the rule of bishops, first step back to the rule of Rome. God raised up men of great caliber and great courage to defend his truth and liberty, gave Scotland some of its greatest ever ministers, men of learning and spiritual stature and power. As I've said, in 1638, the nation entered into covenant with God, what one writer has very aptly, appropriately called the marriage of the nation with God. That's how they looked on their covenant. We were singing tonight Mrs. Cousins' hymn, based on the writings of Samuel Rutherford. Samuel Rutherford was a brilliant university professor, a Latinist of the very first quality. He gave up his professorship to go to a little country parish called Anwath. It seemed to be such a waste. And yet there he gave the world an example of the greatest pastoral ministry you could imagine, a soul-winning ministry. He was banished to Aberdeen in almost what we would call house arrest. And from there he carried on a correspondence. You can still get the book, The Letters of Samuel Rutherford. And they have been a blessing to millions. Samuel Rutherford, the sweet divine who said, "The Lamb is all the glory in Emmanuel's land," was also one of the greatest constitutional scholars of the age. In the book called Lex Rex, which simply means law is king, that was heresy in the days of the monarchy of the Stuarts, he said, and this you'd think was an American said this, but no, this was Samuel Rutherford, "Power is the birthright of the people, borrowed from them. They may let it out for their good and may resume it when a man is drunk with it." Many a man had his head cut off for saying this. And had he not died when he did, no doubt, under Charles II, he would have lost his head. The Scots took that to heart, and as I've already showed you, Charles I set in motion a war. Charles II tried to carry it on to subdue the nation. And then James II came along even more venomous than the others and introduced the killing times. All I can say to you in the time that's available to me tonight, you should, and I know many of you have, you should lay your hands on some of the literature of the Scottish Covenanting period. The stories of men, ministers of the gospel, who gave up their charges, as did 2,000 others in England in the Great Ejection of 1662. Others who went out to live in caves and dens of the earth, to hold meetings in the open air, knowing that at any moment they could be attacked by a squad of dragoons who had every right to kill them or take them into captivity. Ministers who were often tortured, then led to the gallows to die a martyr's death. Children. In Scottish history, there's one of the most touching times was the production of the Children's Covenant, when the children of the nation rose up to say, "We also believe this gospel, and we also will live for it or die for it." Can you imagine such a time? Joan will not like me saying this, but years ago she used to say poems, perform poems, not perform, I orate poems, whatever you say. One of them was about that period in Scottish covenanting history. And the little boy was taking a loaf of bread from his mother to his pastor, hiding in the caves. Caught by the dragoons and forced, as they thought, to tell where the preacher was, and he wouldn't tell. The commander took him to a cliff face and held him over and says, "You will tell me or I'll drop you to your death." And the little boy looks at him trembling, and he looks down, he says, "It's very deep." "But it's not so deep as hell." That was the spirit. James Guthrie, as he stood on the gallows, he said, "I judge it better to suffer than to sin." That was the spirit, not only of the covenanters, who had to wait the glorious revolution of 1688 to gain relief from the killing times. It was not only the heart of the covenanters, but of all the pilgrims and of all the Puritans. That's why they were Puritans. "I judge it better to suffer than to sin." That was the driving force behind their quest. Quest for purity. Doctrinal purity. Ecclesiastical purity, personal purity. What they believed in for the church, they believed in for themselves. And a liberty to worship God according to the Scriptures. One thing we can say about the Puritans and about the Pilgrims: they had a single-minded zeal to pursue the quest that God had burned into their heart. They didn't wish their liberty to become unbridled license. They would never have accepted the virtual ban on Christianity from public life as we have it today. They would never have encountered or countenanced the unprincipled and unbiblical drive to unite orthodoxy with heresy as we have it today. No, they wanted purity of doctrine and of life. And within the purity of the gospel, they wanted liberty for Christians to obey God according to a conscience enlightened by that word. Men and women, that's the quest they have bequeathed to us. We are unfaithful to them. More importantly, we are unfaithful to their Christ and ours if we fail to pursue it. Rise up, O men of God. Have done with lesser things, with such a quest. Is there anything should compete for the heart of a Christian?